Testing. Testing, testing. 1, 2, 3. Testing, test, test, test. 1, 2, 3, 4. A, B, C, D. Test. 1, 2, 3, 4. How's that, Jamie? You got it? No? Okay, keep trying. 1, 2, 3, 4. Test, test, test. 1, 2, 3, 4. Test. 1, 2. That's a little louder. 3, 4. That's pretty good. Test. 1, 2, 3, 4. 1, 2, 3, 4. Okay? Test, test. 1, 2, 3, 4. 1, 2, 3. Test. 2, 3, 4. Test. 1, 2. More? Test. 1, 2, 3, 4. 1, 2. Test. 3. Test. 4. Test. 5. Test. Hi, Janet. Janet has arrived. Test. 1, 2, 3, 4. Okay. Okay, everybody, we're going to get started. So let me introduce Hugh here in a moment. Hey, good morning, or good day. Welcome to Dr. Hugh Ross's Paradoxes class, Sunday school class. It's October 16th, 2022. We're broadcasting from Christ Church Sierra Madre, Southern California. Dr. Ross is with us today. He's going to be talking on no matter how big you think God is, he is bigger. So go online to paradoxes.org and click on the highlighted line. You can go in. You can also find our calendar there. Save your questions till the end. You can send them in on Q&A, and we'll broadcast them back to Dr. Hugh. Dr. Ross, come on up.
Testing. Some people say I lisp, but I seldom observe it. Oh, we're good now. Okay, thank you. All right, well, as Mark announced, I'll be speaking for about 30 to 35 minutes and taking questions, and we'll be taking questions from people here personally, as well, and alternating with those that are participating through YouTube Live. This is a brand new talk I've developed, and I'm going to be actually having to deliver it next month at a couple of different places back east. So I really appreciate your feedback. Anything you can suggest is a way to make this better. Although they've asked me, please don't take suggestions to make it longer, because I am going to be constrained in my time. So the point here is no matter how big you think God is, he's actually bigger than that. I'm an astronomer. I'm going to try to help you get started on thinking how big God is. But I'm not only going to talk about the bigness of God in terms of vastness of the universe, but how he is actually wanting to have an intimate relationship with each one of us. Well, to get you started, here's an image of our star, the sun. And this next one is to scale, showing the size of the sun relative to the size of the earth. So it gives you an idea that the sun is a whole lot bigger than the earth. In fact, you can squeeze 1,300,000 Earths into the interior of the sun. So now you know that stars are big. Okay, but our star, the sun, is by no means the biggest star in the universe. There are stars that are smaller than the sun. So the sun is considered a medium-sized star. Well, medium in the sense that about 80% of the stars in the universe are a little bit smaller than the sun, but a lot of them are a lot bigger. So this next slide is basically showing you the sun over there on the left, and then you've got Sirius, which is the brightest star in the sky. You can see how much bigger Sirius is. The star Pollux that you see, and then we got the star Arcturus, which is in the constellation Bootes. If you go out tonight, the brightest big orange star early in the evening is the star Arcturus. But even Arcturus, as big as it is not the biggest star we see. The biggest bright star we see in the sky is the star Antares. This shows you the relative size of Antares to Arcturus. Antares is the brightest star in the constellation Scorpio. Now, another way to visualize the size of Antares is that if it were in the solar system, it would completely encompass the orbit of Mars. It would not only incinerate Earth, it would incinerate Mars as well. In fact, it's so big, it actually goes a good way out towards the distance to Jupiter. Now, you're probably aware the universe is filled with stars, lots of stars. This is a globular cluster. It's a globular cluster, Messier 2, and it shows a few of the stars in the globular cluster, but the total number of stars is about 150,000 stars. So one cluster, 150,000 stars. And there are over 150 globular clusters in our Milky Way galaxy. And Messier 2 is not the biggest. This one is the biggest. It's the Omega Centauri globular cluster, and it contains 10 million stars. Now, our Milky Way galaxy is considered to be a large galaxy. It comes in at about 1.2 trillion times the mass of our star, the Sun. But they're galaxies. It actually is unusual in that it has so few globular clusters, 152. Most big galaxies have way more than that. So for example, this is the Big Elliptical Galaxy that's in the near the center of the Virgo cluster of galaxies. And all those little dots you see there surrounding this elliptical galaxy, they're not stars, they're globular clusters. In fact, Messier 87 has 15,000 globular clusters. Our Milky Way galaxy, 152, Messier 87, 15,000. They're still counting of at least 15,000. And there are galaxies that are as big as 1,000 times bigger than our Milky Way galaxy. Many of you have probably seen this. This is what's called the Hubble Ultra Deep Field. It's where they took the Hubble Space Telescope, focused it on a tiny part of the sky that measured about 1/15th the angular diameter of the moon. And then they integrated for over a two-week period. So as the Hubble Space Telescope focused on that one tiny part of the sky, and they collected light for over 2 weeks. And it was the deepest survey, in fact, it's the deepest survey of any part of the universe that's been taken to date. And they looked at this and said, look at all those background galaxies billions of light years away. Matter of fact, in this particular image, now only two points of light are stars. Everything else is distant galaxies. So everything you see there is a galaxy. And in looking at this, astronomers determined that there had to be over 200 billion galaxies in the observable universe. And in the last few weeks, we've been privileged with having images come from the James Webb Space Telescope. Well, here's a deep image of a cluster of galaxies taken by the Hubble Space Telescope. And what I want to show you is not a long exposure, but a relatively short exposure taken by the James Webb Space Telescope of the same part of the sky. This is the interior of a cluster of galaxies. So this basically shows you how much more powerful the James Webb Space Telescope is, and even a short exposure, they were able to reveal a lot more galaxies in this cluster of galaxies than the Hubble Space Telescope was able to show. But more than that, most of the galaxies you see in this image are not part of that cluster of galaxies. They're actually galaxies that are billions of light years more distant. So you look in the background of this image, you're basically seeing little tiny points of light. Those tiny points of light are giant galaxies that are located 10, 11, 12, 13 billion light years away. And then this is the best image ever taken by the Hubble Space Telescope of a grouping of galaxies known as Stefan's Quintet. Although only the four yellow-colored galaxies are gravitationally linked, the blue one you see there is a foreground galaxy. So this is the deepest image taken by the Hubble Space Telescope. Again, the James Webb Space Telescope took a much shorter exposure, but this is what it was able to see. Not only were you able to get more details on the five galaxies, as you look in the background, you can see hundreds of small points of light. Those are all distant galaxies. And based on just three of the images taken by the James Webb Space Telescope, I mean, it's only been doing astronomy since late July. So it's only the past couple of months that it's actually been delivering for us these images. But it's such that astronomers now recognize that the observable universe contains 2 trillion galaxies. 2 trillion galaxies, where on average every galaxy has over 100 billion stars, and you just saw how big the stars are. Clearly, we live in a big universe. The universe is big. But all those stars and galaxies, nebulae we see, planets, all that stuff, it only adds up to 0.27% of all the stuff of the universe. Most of the universe is comprised of dark stuff, dark energy, exotic dark matter, ordinary dark matter. That accounts for 99.73% of the totality of the universe. So the Creator made the universe really big, but He made it exactly as big as it needs to be for all of you to be sitting here in the chairs in front of me. What astronomers have been able to determine, if you take the total quantity of dark stuff and change it by as little as 1 part in 10 to the 122nd power, no physical life would be possible at any time, anywhere in the universe. That's 122 zeros after the one. To give you some idea of how remote that possibility is, there's only 10 to the 79 protons and neutrons and electrons in the universe. And so we're looking at something 1 part in 10 to the 122nd power. So make the universe the slightest bit bigger or the slightest bit smaller, none of us would be sitting here. In fact, this ranks as the most spectacular evidence for fine-tuned design, as not only showing us how big and powerful the Creator God is, but just showing how meticulous He is in designing the universe so we all could be here, literally fine-tuning it to a degree that ranks 10 to the 97 times more powerful and comprehensive than anything we human beings can be capable of. I mean, the very best example of human engineering achievement is to design something that's fine-tuned within 1 part in 10 to the 26th power. So what we're seeing here is a level of fine-tuned design just in this one feature of the universe that ranks a trillion, 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 trillion times superior to anything we human beings have ever achieved. Basically making the point that God is at least 10 to the 96 times more intelligent, more knowledgeable, more powerful, and bigger than we human beings. Now, we know this must be by the hand of the God of the Bible because of the space-time theorems. Over 30 of these theorems have been published in the scientific literature. The most famous one has the conclusion, any universe that expands on average, and only universes that expand on average will permit the existence of physical life. So the fact that you're here is evidence that this theorem indeed has the conclusion that it does. Any universe that expands on average has a beginning, implying a causal agent outside of space and time that creates our universe's space, time, matter, and energy. I said the God of the Bible, because what we see in the gods of the other religions of the world, they create within space and time. The God of the Bible creates independent of space and time. The universe, when it came into existence, was also the moment when space and time was created, when space and time began. And the Bible said this thousands of years ago. I mean, one example is what you see in 2 Timothy 1:9. The grace that we experience, that was given to us in Christ Jesus, was put into effect before the beginning of time. So this God that created this incredibly large universe and designed it to a very meticulous degree, he was actually active. He was involved doing things before time even existed. Now, a question I get is that this God beyond space and time, this God that is so distant, beyond 13.8 billion years, how can a God beyond the universe hear all of our prayers? Because this is a core teaching of the Bible, that God pays attention to prayers. Well, I mean, there's 7.5 billion human beings on the planet today. I mean, what if all 7.5 billion were to pray to God at exactly the same time? Wouldn't that jam up God's phone lines? Well, it would if God were constrained in linear time like we are. Any entity that's in a single dimension of time, where time can't be stopped or reversed, they have to do things sequentially. But we're talking about a God who created time. The space-time theorems tell us that he can create space-time dimensions at will. So if he were to so choose, he could create multiple time dimensions. Now, he had very good reasons for creating the universe with a single dimension of time, and very good reasons for constraining all of us human beings to that single dimension of time. So because of that, we have to engage one another linearly. And because we're in a single dimension of time, we have a beginning within that time. We have a moment. We have a creation event. But a God that exists beyond time, a God that has the power to create as many space-time dimensions as he chooses and to remove them whenever he decides, is not so constrained. So, for example, we can imagine that God is moving and operating not just in a single line of time, but in a plane of time. And in a plane of time, you can have our timeline of the universe over here, and at one moment, 7.5 billion of us all pray to God at the same time. That's not a problem for God, because he could exist on a timeline perpendicular to ours. So in our instant, 1 microsecond goes by, but because he can operate in a timeline perpendicular to ours, he can take infinite time to pay individual attention to every prayer uttered by 7.5 billion people that all pray at once. And of course, we shouldn't worry if the human population gets up to 9 billion. He'll be able to listen to 9 billion prayers all simultaneously. Now, it's not just that God's got access to the equivalent of extra dimensions of time. He also has access to the equivalent of extra dimensions of space. And we know this from the Large Hadron Collider. The Large Hadron Collider, the most powerful particle accelerator in the world, combined with particle physicists who have been working on what's called unified field theory, which is based on cosmology. The Big Bang model tells us that the universe begins in an infinitely small volume and nearly infinitely hot. And with its very hot temperature, that means all the forces of physics are united. And so gravity, electromagnetism, the strong and weak nuclear force at the beginning of the universe is a single force. But as the universe expands, that single force becomes two, and then it becomes three, and then it becomes four. In fact, we have four forces of physics by the time the universe is about a billionth of a second old. It all happens very quickly. But what these particle physicists have discovered in looking at this theory is that there's simply not enough room within the dimensions of length, width, and height for all the symmetries required by this unified field theory based on Big Bang cosmology. And also, there's not enough room for all the symmetries required by quantum mechanics and gravity. And it was a team at Caltech 20 years ago, led by John Swartz, who began to work on this problem. How can we make all the symmetries fit so we can have both quantum mechanics and gravity? And it was understood, if we don't have both gravity and quantum mechanics coexisting, there's no possibility for physical life. We need both for physical life to exist. And 20 years ago, they said, well, we know the answer. We need a minimum of 8 dimensions of space, and it can't be more than 26 dimensions of space. It took them another 15 years to figure out where it falls. The answer is 9 dimensions of space. If you want to explain how you get all the fundamental particles, how that one force becomes gravity, electromagnetism, the strong and weak nuclear force, we need 9 dimensions of space, where the universe starts off with these 9 space dimensions. They all rapidly expand from the cosmic creation event. And when the universe is 10 to the minus 43 seconds old, that's when gravity separates out from the other 3 forces of physics. You get a symmetry breaking, which causes 6 of those 9 dimensions to stop expanding. They're still here today, but those 6 are no bigger than what they were when the universe was 10 to the minus 43 seconds old. Probably why a lot of us haven't paid attention to them. After all, their size dimension is a trillion, a billion times smaller than the diameter of an electron. So, but they're crucial for us to be able to integrate our cosmic creation model with our particle creation model. That means that the God that created the universe, at a minimum, has the capability of moving and operating in the equivalent of 2 dimensions of time and 9 dimensions of space. God must exist and operate both within and beyond the 1 time dimension and the 9 space dimensions. Or as what we see in the Bible, it tells us that God is simultaneously and continuously both immanent and transcendent. And this is unique to the Bible. You've got religions like Islam that teach that God is transcendent, that he's beyond the universe. And you've got religions like Hinduism that teach that God is constrained within the universe. Christianity is unique in saying it's both, that God exists outside the universe, totally free to operate without restriction outside of the universe of matter, energy, space, and time, but he's everywhere active, everywhere operating within the entirety of our physical universe of space, time, matter, and energy. And because he is beyond, it says in 1 Timothy 6:16, no one has seen God, no one can see God. I mean, that's the doctrine of the transcendence. If God is truly transcendent to matter, energy, space, and time, it'll be impossible for us to see God. It'll be impossible for us to touch God. And if God is truly transcendent, that must be true about God. You know, people say, well, if God exists, why can't I see him and touch him? Well, if God really does exist, you can't see and touch him because it takes a God outside of space and time to create it. On the other hand, God tells us that he's not far from each one of us. The doctrine of immanence is basically saying God is operating everywhere within the universe. He's present everywhere in the universe, able to act everywhere in the universe. And basically, as close as some of you are sitting together in front of me, God is actually physically closer to you than the next person adjacent to you. He's within a millimeter away from each one of us. Now, it tells us that God sees us in a way we don't see one another. Man looks at the outward appearance, but the Lord looks at the heart. And this is a message you see in the Bible. Because God is immanent, he knows and understands us better than we know and understand ourselves. And one of the ways I've demonstrated this in front of audiences is to bring like a cutout figure of Mr. and Mrs. Flat. I didn't bring them with me today, but I'm just going to let you imagine that we've got a flatland universe here where we have just length and width, a universe where there's no height, and we put flatland people here, and they engage one another. And as they look at one another, what do they see? They don't see the outline, they just see a line. And they have to walk around one another repeatedly in order to figure out the outline that they have. And they never can see the interior of one another. They can't see the interior themselves. They can't see the interior of their fellow flatland people. But if I come in as a three-dimensional being with three space dimensions, I can look above them, and I look down on them, and I can see the outline immediately, and I see everything that's inside, something that they can never see. Now, the God that created the universe has many dimensions of advantage over us. And so it says, he sees things in ourselves that we can never see. But this implies that the God that created the universe knows and understands each one of us better than we know and understand ourselves. And a core part of becoming a Christian, entering into an eternal loving relationship with the creator of the universe, is coming to the recognition that God knows and understands each one of us better than we know and understand one another. And therefore, becoming a Christian is basically saying, God, I know you know me better than I know myself. It only makes rational sense to put you in charge of my life because you know better than I do what's good and best for me. I'm going to make you the master of my life and take direction from you. That's a core feature of becoming a Christian. Of course, the other core feature is recognizing that God desires to trade our moral perfection for our moral imperfection. More about that in a minute. But let me go right here. Often when I engage skeptics, they will say, well, the Christian doctrine declares that this man, Jesus of Nazareth, died on the cross. And when he died on the cross, he paid the atonement price for every offense that every human being has ever committed against God and against one another. And, you know, each one of us, no matter how righteous we are, have offended a lot of people. We've done damage to a lot of people. And, of course, we've really offended God by the way we've rejected him and abused him. And the Bible tells us that Jesus of Nazareth, when he died on the cross, basically took upon himself the penalty for all the offenses that every human being has ever committed. But if you read the gospel accounts carefully, all four address the death of Jesus Christ on the cross. And as you piece together these gospel accounts, he spent at least 6 hours on the cross, but not more than 9 hours on the cross, which means within 6 to 9 hours, according to the New Testament, he was able to pay the atonement price for all the offenses of humanity. If you want a good analogy, think of what happens when you get stopped for speeding and the policeman gives you a ticket, and you're looking at that ticket, and hey, where I live, you're looking at about a $500 fine because they put all these other taxes on it. You know all about that. This is California, after all. We live in a fine state. And you look at your bank account and say, I don't have $500, but your neighbor comes along and says, you know what? I know you're in a tough spot. I'll pay that fine for you. That's basically what Jesus did on the cross. He says, I'm going to pay the penalty price for every offense that you've ever committed. But he only spent 6 to 9 hours on the cross. But what I want to imagine for you here in this demonstration is that as you look at the screen here, we have Jesus of Nazareth dying on the cross. And this line that you see here, I want you to imagine it coming out from behind the screen and forward. So he's on a timeline that goes from behind the screen forward. And on that timeline, our timeline, he spends 6 to 9 hours. But the man that was dying on the cross was not just a human being. He was God. He was the one that created the universe. And therefore, he had access to a second dimension of time. In this case, a line that goes up and down along the screen. And he could exist in our time space of 6 to 9 hours, infinite time on that other line. So for us it's 6 to 9 hours, and he can exist for infinite time. And then we can imagine a third dimension of time where you can have 120 billion infinitely long lines of time that are parallel to one another. You say, where did you come up with 120 billion? That's a rough estimate for how many human beings have lived since the time of Adam and Eve up until the present day, and maybe on into the next decade or two, 120 billion. But what you're seeing here is that in 6 to 9 hours, literally, you could have that man on the cross, Jesus of Nazareth, suffering eternal torment on 120 billion infinitely long lines of time. Because after all, he's got access to more dimensions of time. And all this can be compressed into just 6 to 9 hours in our limited dimension of time. So this is one way. I'm not saying this is how Jesus of Nazareth did it. After all, this is a big God. He's got multiple ways in which he can atone for the penalty price of every human being who ever lived. I'm just saying this is one way, a helpful way, for us to visualize what Jesus of Nazareth actually suffered on the cross on behalf of all of us. One way he could pay the atonement price in 6 to 9 hours for the billions of people who ever lived. Now, one of my favorite verses, which you see in Hebrews 2:3, where the author of Hebrews says, "How shall we escape if we ignore such a great salvation?" And many refuse the offer that Jesus made in the cross because they don't realize the magnitude of what he did for us on the cross. If we realize how big the Creator is, and as big as he was, what he was able to do for us while he suffered on the cross, then how can anyone in their own rational mind turn down such a magnificent offer? But that's one rationale for this talk I'm giving, is basically making the point, God is a whole lot bigger than you even think he is, and this is not a problem for God. Matter of fact, he's got a million other ways he could atone for the price of every human being who ever lived. If you want to read more about this, you can read my book, Beyond the Cosmos. Anyone can get a free chapter of this book at reasons.org/Ross. And we've also produced a DVD series, mainly geared towards young people, children and youth, that make the same point. But I want to close this talk off by saying, as big as this God is, his desire is not to wait till after you die to enter into a relationship with him. He wants you to experience that right now. And so he's given us certain tools, like prayer. Prayer is the most powerful tool God has granted to us. And because it's so powerful, God has actually put restrictions on its use, instructions about how we should not pray, instructions how we should pray. And if we follow those instructions, we will begin to experience on a day-by-day basis the personal presence and operation of God within our lives as we see him answering those prayers in miraculous ways. He also wants us to be involved in partnership and ministering. I mean, his goal is to bring billions of human beings into a relationship with himself, an eternal relationship where they're going to be able to experience and express love at a degree that's thousands, millions, exponentially greater than when any human being is capable of experiencing here on earth. But he also wants to give you a foretaste. And so the promise is, if you will prepare good reasons for your faith and hope in Jesus Christ and are able to present those reasons to people who are not yet followers of Jesus Christ with gentleness, respect, and a clear conscience, he will supernaturally bring people to you that he is prepared in advance to hear and respond to those good reasons. And I've written a book on this called Always Be Ready, because that's kind of what you see there. Always be prepared to give good reasons. And it means not just the reasons that are good for you, it's the reasons that are good for the person you're sharing your faith with. And so the scriptures tell us, be hospitable to people, ask questions, care for them, be compassionate. Why? So that you'll be able to figure out what good reasons they need to hear from you. And the promise is, if you do this, God will work miracles in your life. And the key point there is that you'll begin to experience on a day-by-day basis the power of God working in your life, and basically make the point, yes, it's a God that is so big, he's beyond the universe, but it's a God that operates moment by moment within every split centimeter of and every split second everywhere within the universe. He will do that for each one of us. You know, I've been serving as a pastor in this church now for 47 years, and what I've realized is people who put this into practice, they will experience the intimacy of God working in their life. And the first couple of times it happens, you're going to think, maybe this is just a coincidence. But when it happens over 100 times, you realize this is the Spirit of God at work. This is a God who cares for me. A God that created a universe with 2 trillion galaxies, where that's only 0.27% of all the stuff in the universe. This is a God who cares enough for me that he singles me out as an individual and says, I want to demonstrate my power and my love within you, not after you die, but right now. Get you started and realize this is just the beginning. And what happens in the new creation is going to be so big and so marvelous, no one can think or imagine how great and wonderful it will be. 1 Corinthians 2:9. But it's all from a God, no matter how big you think he is, he's bigger than that. Okay. I actually closed at 30 minutes. So I'll take questions.
Any in-house questions?
Any in-house questions? We're going to alternate between in-house.
Right, wait till you get the mic, head. Okay? And then.
You mentioned that there are some prayers that we shouldn't pray.
Right.
And I was reading in 1 John chapter 5, verses 16 and 17, and I was just wondering what you had to say about this, where it says, if you see any brother or sister commit a sin that does not lead to death, you should pray, and God will give them life. I refer to those whose sin does not lead to death. There is a sin that leads to death. I am not saying that you should pray about that. All wrongdoing is sin, and there is sin that does not lead to death. Okay? It almost sounds like, you know, as a Christian, you think that, you know, all sin leads to death. But that's not what this guy is saying right now. John's not saying that.
He's not.
How do you read that?
Okay. He's basically saying that we should be praying for people. But he says there's a select number of people we should not pray for. And if you read other passages of Scripture, it says you need to minister to people. But there's certain people you should stay away from. It's basically saying there's certain individuals where they're beyond hope because they've rejected God to such an extreme degree. I mean, a good example you see in the book of Exodus is Pharaoh. The king of Egypt, and how Pharaoh had hardened his heart, and hardened his heart so consistently that he became beyond reach. He became reprobate in his behavior, which means everything that he could think was evil. Every thought was evil. Every act was evil. I mean, you see a description about the individuals that cohabited with Noah, where it says all they could think about all the time is how to do physical harm to their fellow human beings. Basically making the point, if you try to reach out and help these people, they're going to attack you. They're bent on doing physical harm. Moreover, what it tells us in the last verse of Romans 1, people in this category not only are committed to do as much evil as possible, they're evangelists for evil. They're not content just to do evil. They want to draw in as many other people to do evil with them, which means that close contact with these individuals is dangerous. It's just like telling your child, don't put your hand on a hot stove. You're going to get hurt. Well, God is telling us, don't try to help these people. You will get hurt. And so we're not to pray for them, and we're not to minister to them. On the other hand, we need to be very careful not to identify someone in this position until we have overwhelming evidence that that's the kind of individual they are. I mean, I remember doing marriage counseling in this church where a woman would tell me that her husband was a reprobate. So I would go talk to him and said, well, he doesn't have any of the biblical characteristics of a reprobate. The Bible gives us 57 character attributes of the reprobate. And I always tell people, don't label someone as a reprobate until they got at least 40 of those 57 characteristics. And in this case, when I talked to the husband, I couldn't identify any one of the 57. Now, they had marriage issues they needed to deal with. And the woman clearly felt like her husband really was abusing her. So it's like, okay, you got some issues you need to work on, but let me assure you, your husband is not a reprobate. So again, that's an important caveat. And also we need to realize God does not allow reprobates to live long because they're doing harm to everybody around them. And the longer God allows a reprobate to live, the more torment that reprobate's going to experience in the lake of fire, because it tells us in Revelation 20, the torment will be in proportion to the evil that they commit. So it's not to God's advantage or the reprobate's advantage for God to let them continue living. And we see that God typically brings death to those individuals in short order, if for no other reason, as an act of mercy to the reprobate. And you say, well, you know, why does God do that? Well, the Greek word for torment in Revelation 20 is one of restraint. It's basically saying God's going to restrain the individuals in hell in proportion to the evil they commit, and for good reason. The more evil that they've committed, the more harm they can do to their fellow inhabitants in the lake of fire. So that's the value of the restraint, often referred to as torment. But thank you for raising that question. Jesus, for example, gave a lot of instructions on prayer. He basically said, we're not to pray repeatedly, just the same words over and over again. Our prayers are not to be vague. I mean, so often when I've prayed, the message I hear from God is, well, yes, I know you want your father to come to faith in Christ. Tell me how. He wants specifics. And that's what it means. When we pray to God, we get more and more specific. After all, the goal is to determine exactly how and when and where God's going to do what you're asking to do. He wants details. He does not honor repetitive prayers. He does not honor vague prayers.
Okay.
From the internet.
Okay, we have an online question from Keith Wilson, New Zealand. All the depictions of black holes and their event horizons are presented as two-dimensional.
Are presented?
As two-dimensional.
Yes.
And then he goes on, but in three dimensions, are they globular?
Okay. Yeah, there's been two images published of black holes. They're difficult to image because, the region where everything can't escape from the black hole, where it's black, even light can't escape, that black hole diameter is really tiny. So it takes an extremely powerful telescope to be able to image the event horizon of a black hole. And there is what's now called the Event Horizon Telescope. It's an array of 18 radio telescopes around the world that they're able to link together as an interferometer and basically produce the equivalent resolving power of a telescope that's 6,000 miles in diameter, way more powerful than the James Webb Space Telescope. And what they're giving you is a two-dimensional image. That's what we astronomers get, are two-dimensional images, because we're doing all of our imaging from this one little location called planet Earth. We can't go very far outside. The James Webb is a million miles away, but that's not much of a distance to try to get a different perspective. So three-dimensional imagery is not possible, but we know enough about the physics of black holes to recognize what we see in two dimensions is going to be the same as what we would see if we look at it in third dimensions. And so the event horizon of a black hole is a perfect sphere. It's not oblong, it's not ellipsoid, it's spherical. We know that from the physics. And black holes continue to shrink as they get older and older. Okay, we had a question here. Wait for the microphone.
There's actually a follow-up. You want to finish it?
Okay, give me the follow-up.
Yeah, it's from Keith also. Secondly, if they are in fact globular, how do astronomers get to see through the surrounding bright event horizon to detect the blackness of the holes within?
Okay. Yeah, again, black holes are spherical. But outside the event horizon is the maximum distance out from the black hole where nothing can escape. But beyond the event horizon, you got matter being sucked into the black hole, and as it approaches the event horizon, it gets converted into energy with 10 to 42% efficiency. So that explains why you look at images of black holes, they look like a donut. So you see this big ring of light around this black circle in the interior. That's because outside the event horizon, this matter is being converted into energy with extremely high efficiency. Again, to give you a comparison, our sun converts matter and energy with 0.07% efficiency. A black hole, 10 to 42% efficiency. So that's why black holes appear to be extremely bright. Quasars are supermassive black holes. The black hole isn't bright, but the little donut around the event horizon is extremely bright. And so that's what astronomers are measuring. Did I answer the question adequately?
I think you got it.
Okay, thank
you. If not, Keith, just send us another one.
Okay, well, we got a question here from Al.
Okay. Did you have a question, Al?
Yeah. Al Lopez.
Al Lopez, okay.
Those figures that we got from the...
Put the microphone closer, because...
Oh,
thank
those,
you.
Those figures that you give about the distances and the the number of galaxies and stars and all that just kind of blows everybody's mind, I think. But with black holes, I forget how they're made. But can you go over that?
Yeah,
but
I
is
can
that,
explain.
And why? And what is a if God has a purpose for black holes? I mean, could we be absorbed in that in a black hole? What? Can they exist everywhere? I've been so long since I've heard your lectures.
Sure. Well, thank you, Al. And I actually wrote a paper on this in a peer-reviewed journal called Black Holes as Evidence of God's Care.
What was that?
Yeah, the title is Black Holes as Evidence of God's Care.
Oh.
You can read the entire paper online. It's available for free. What's also fun is that I drew three atheist astrophysicists as reviewers. And so two of them are pretty upset about me trying to make a link between God and black holes. They had some very interesting statements to make about my paper. But this is a journal that allowed me to respond to their reviews. And it's also, it's interesting, it's a journal that makes public the reviewers' statements and my responses. So if you just simply put into a search engine, black holes as evidence of God's care, the paper will pop up, the reviewer's statements will pop up, and my responses pop up. All that's public. Just put black holes as evidence of God's care, that'll be enough. Or you put Hugh Ross and black holes, that'll bring it up. So it's not that hard to find. But what I made in that point in that paper is that if you want to have stars and galaxies and planets in the universe so that life is possible, black holes are inevitable. There will be black holes. But what's interesting about our area, our neighborhood, is that we're not in danger of any black hole. Black holes are really nasty things to be around because of how energetic matter is being converted into energy. So that little donut, that's what you want to avoid. Really deadly stuff comes out of there.
How do we know where they pop up? I mean, how are they made? What are the conditions?
Okay. How black holes form is that you'll get a supernova eruption, and if it's a big enough star, when it goes through a supernova eruption, the remaining parts of the star are sufficiently massive that it'll collapse into a black hole. That's rare. There's only a few stars in the universe that are big enough where that happens. Far more frequently, you get a supernova eruption and you wind up with a neutron star. However, if you get two neutron stars orbiting one another, which, because a lot of stars are double and triple, and so you've got a probability of actually having a binary star system where both stars end up as neutron stars. Well, all it takes is two neutron stars. And as they begin to orbit one another, they lose gravitational energy and spiral in towards one another and eventually merge. And when they merge, you'll get a black hole. And if you're in the center of the galaxy, this is happening quite frequently because the star density is really high. And so then you get two black holes merging to become a bigger black hole. Then they begin to suck in stars and planets, so the black hole grows. In fact, in the center of every galaxy is a supermassive black hole. And our Milky Way galaxy has a supermassive black hole that weighs 4 million times the mass of our star, the Sun. But it's extraordinarily small given the size of our Milky Way galaxy. We live in the only large galaxy that's got a small supermassive black hole. Andromeda, which is the same size as our Milky Way galaxy, its black hole is 140 million times the mass of our star, the Sun.
So God does not control.
Well, I'm arguing that God is in control because, number one, we happen to live in this galaxy that's got an enormously small supermassive black hole. And also, we humans are living at a time in the history of our Milky Way galaxy where it's on a starvation diet. So our supermassive black hole is only sucking in objects as big as comets and asteroids. And so we do see flares coming out of our center of our galaxy, but none of them are of danger to human life or human civilization. We don't see that in other galaxies. But where it's really showing the evidence of God's care is that when two neutron stars merge together to make a black hole, they produce a half of the elements that are heavier than iron in the periodic table. Those are called R-process elements, rapid neutron capture elements. And only when two neutron stars merge together do you get the neutron density to be able to produce those elements. Well, if those elements didn't exist at a high abundance level, none of us would be here. One of the things about planet Earth is when it was forming, it got exposed to a nearby merger event of two neutron stars, and maybe two or three of them. Because that explains why we have all this uranium, all this thorium, why we have platinum, why we have gold. And incidentally, two R-process elements are in your body, and if they weren't there at a sufficiently high abundance level, you would be dead. And so we need these neutron stars merging to become black holes just to explain how we exist.
Are you saying that without black holes, we wouldn't exist?
Without black holes, we wouldn't be here. Without black holes, we wouldn't have the resources in the crust of the Earth to launch and sustain human civilization. That's why I titled my paper, Black Holes is Evidence of God's Care, because it shows his exquisite care, because we live on this rocky body, planet Earth, that is the champion of the universe for abundance of our process elements. We've got hundreds of times more of those elements than we see in other rocky bodies. But we need all that to explain why we have a magnetic field, why we have plate tectonics, and why we have all the elements we need to launch and sustain civilization. It's evidence for God's care. Hey, if you want to read more, go Google, get that paper. You can read it free online. Black holes is evidence of God's care. Mm-hmm. And you can read what the atheists had to say about my paper and how I responded to them.
Okay, Hugh, we got an online question here from Doug McComb. How close do you think we are to producing cold fusion? And will the helium-3 on the moon ever play a role in this?
Okay, question about cold fusion. And I remember when I was an undergraduate student taking a course in plasma physics, and I took a couple more courses as a graduate student. This was back in the 1960s. They were saying, by the end of the 20th century, we're gonna have controlled fusion reactors, and we're gonna have all the energy we need at a ridiculously low price. It turned out to be a more than optimistic prediction, because here we are in 2022, and we're really not doing too well in trying to pursue controlled fusion. It's still a major effort, but it's basically what you're trying to do is use magnetism or laser light to constrain deuterium and helium. Yeah, the easiest way to do it is to take deuterium and helium, deuterium and tritium, and make helium, although you get a lot of nasty radioactivity when you do that. But what they've discovered is it's really difficult to constrain a small volume of deuterium and tritium inside a manufactured magnetic bottle. The bottle is unstable. And what we discover in astronomy is the only way to get a stable magnetic bubble to constrain these things is if you got a lot of gravity. So it works for the sun because you got this enormous force of gravity, and so the sun uses gravity to constrain these elements so that you get hydrogen fusing into helium. Now, for us, gravity is not an option because you need something as big as a star to make that work. And so we're trying to do with electromagnetic radiation. What we're discovering is that there's huge technical difficulties there. And so I'm not confident that we'll ever have fusion nuclear reactors. And I'm certainly not confident that they'll be cheap. If somehow we're able to pull it off by scaling it up, it's going to be a very expensive form of energy. We need to be pursuing other sources of energy. And also, the projects that are being worked on by a number of governments in the world, they're all trying to fuse deuterium and tritium to make helium. Tritium is extremely radioactive, very dangerous. I'm advocating we do it the way the sun does it. Take hydrogen and make helium-4. When you do that, there's no radioactivity. But the engineering difficulties are way more challenging than working with deuterium and tritium. So you're wondering why they're doing that is because the engineering is easier, but they need to think through it. Tritium is not a fun thing to handle. It's incredibly deadly and dangerous.
Mm-hmm. Is it the same thing as the regular fusion that they're trying to work on? And cold fusion, is that the same as hot fusion? Or?
Well, cold fusion was in the literature a decade ago, and they're saying, hey, you know, maybe we can make this work at low temperatures, in which case you don't have to have all these technical difficulties. However, I remember writing an article about it and just saying, cold fusion, if it was working, would have killed the experimenters. Since the experimenters survived, we know that cold fusion wasn't happening. And so today, nobody is advocating cold fusion. Everybody realizes it can't be done. It violates the laws of physics.
Okay. One more. Raymond's got, back here, Dan's got a question. Let me go to him first.
Sir, is your theory of how the sun was formed? I mean, it's unique with all that energy. How?
Are you asking me how does the sun form?
Yeah, how was it made? Or you think, how
well,
it came to be?
Well, if I had time, I would have shown you some James Webb Space Telescope images. The latest ones really are giving us a very clear insight on how stars form. Basically, stars form in these giant molecular clouds. A good example would be the Orion Nebula. If you stay up really late tonight, you can see the Orion Nebula. It's in the constellation Orion. It's the sword that hangs down from the belt of Orion. The middle star of the sword is the Orion Nebula. You can actually see it with the naked eye. There's hundreds of those nebulae within our Milky Way galaxy. And astronomers refer to them as the maternity wards of our galaxy. It's where stars are being born. And what's happening is that these giant molecular gas clouds, there's a lot of gas movement going on there, and some of that gas is being expanded, but there are regions within those giant molecular clouds where you see gas being collapsed. And if you get enough gravitational forces working to collapse the gas cloud, that gas cloud will collapse sufficiently to form a star. And the greater the mass of the collapsing piece of the gas cloud, the faster the star forms. Say, how fast? Well, the fastest stars will form in about 100,000 years. The slowest will take tens of millions of years to form. So somewhere within that range. And people have said, well, you know, I'm disappointed. Astronomers have never watched a giant molecular cloud collapse sufficiently to form a star in real time. And I said, well, astronomers at most live only 100 years. That's just a tiny fraction of that 100,000-year window. However, we've seen thousands of images of gas clouds in different stages of collapse. And as we put those thousands together, they tell us in detail exactly how the stars form, what's the relationship between the mass and the time that it forms, and what will they be composed of. So it's very well understood. Anyone that's interested, there are excellent textbooks that you can get on star formation. You know, I took a course when I was in astronomy on how stars form. But there's lots of textbooks now that are accessible for lay people. Of course, and you say, well, how do you find them? Well, open up the book, and if it's 50% equation, see if you can find a book that's more of an introduction. But they're out there. There are good books for lay people on star formation.
So we'll never run out of stars. They're always self-forming.
Right? Well, we will run out of stars, Al, because the universe is expanding. As it continues to expand, it's going to be more and more challenging to find places in these gas clouds where the gas is contracting. And right now, star formation is active and throughout the whole of the universe. However, in galaxies as old as our Milky Way galaxy, which is about 13 billion years old, we can see that star formation is slowing down. It was much more active, say, 9 billion years ago than it is today. As we go into the future, star formation will be slowing down everywhere in the universe, and there will come a time, if you wait long enough, where there won't be any star formation going on at all. So no stars will be forming, stars will be burning out, and there will come a time when there'll be no stars to see in the universe, because they'll all be burnt out. They'll all be black holes, neutron stars, or black dwarfs. But you gotta wait a while. I mean, what's interesting is that we don't see a single black dwarf anywhere in the universe. A black dwarf is a burnt out star where it's cooled sufficiently that it's no longer emitting light. We do see lots of dead stars. We call them white dwarfs. They've stopped burning through nuclear fusion, but they're in a process of cooling down. They start off like at 30,000 degrees surface temperature, and we can see some that are at 10,000 degrees. But at 10,000 degrees, they're still pretty bright in the sky. None of them have cooled all the way down to where they're being black. The universe is far too young to have any black dwarf stars. That's one reason why we know the universe isn't a trillion years old. If it was a trillion years old, we'd be seeing black dwarf stars. We don't see any, which means it's only billions of years old.
Okay, Hugh, I got one online question here, and then Norm or Raymond, one of them will be next. But this is Marcus Hewitt. I struggle to reconcile biblical miracles with science. Scientifically, how could Jesus multiply loaves of bread and fish to feed thousands or walk on water? Are matter and energy manipulated?
Okay, the Bible tells us in multiple places that the laws of physics don't change, which means there's going to be things that we human beings can't do. But the creator of the universe is the one that created the laws of physics. He created space, time, matter, and energy. He transcends the universe. So the creator of the universe is not constrained by the physics of the universe. We are. We're constrained by the physics of the universe, but the creator is not. And again, Jesus of Nazareth was fully human, but also fully God. Therefore, he could walk on water. And he was able to help Peter walk on water, but it took the intervention of Jesus for Peter to be able to walk on water. He created space and time. So he can make an axe head float, he can walk on water, he can take a few loaves and a couple of fish and multiply them to feed 5,000 men plus women and children. He can do all that. And that's what you see in the Gospel of John. In the Gospel of John, it makes the point, well, the prophets perform miracles. And as I was mentioning at the end of my talk, God performs miracles through us. So we get to experience these miracles. But in the Gospel of John, it describes the miracles that Jesus of Nazareth performed that we humans are not able to experience, even with God's help. But what you see in the Gospel of John is Jesus doing the miracles that the prophets were not able to do. Basically making the point, this man really is the one that created the universe, because he's able to do greater miracles. And keep in mind, the Bob Mill also says that God has granted power to the angels to perform miracles. So sometimes the miracles that we perform is not at our hand. It's basically God sending an angel, and the angel is able to do things that we can't do. Yes,
yeah.
Norm.
Hi. You mentioned that the James Webb Telescope is collecting data confirming how our stars form. But on the other hand, you described the theories that we've had on how stars form in our textbooks. So I think all you're saying is that James Webb Telescope is confirming what theory has told us for a long time as far as the formation of stars.
That is correct, Norm, that the James Webb Telescope is affirming what we already knew about star formation. However, it's going to give us a much more detailed picture of the physics of star formation, mainly because with the Hubble Space Telescope and other ground-based telescopes, we've been able to observe thousands of stars at different stages in formation. James Webb will boost that up to millions. And so we're going to have a much larger database, which is going to give us a much more detailed picture, and not just in general how stars form, but in detail, moment by moment by moment, how they form. And also will give us some insight on what will happen in the future of those stars after they form.
Well, I guess my point was a little bit to infer how effective the theory and the development of these things, how good it was.
So that's important, Norm, because there's been a lot of speculation. The James Webb Space Telescope is going to overturn everything we know about the universe. And hey, it's only been in operation since July, but everything it's been revealing since July is affirming astrophysics. It's not overturning it.
Right.
And yes, we may learn some subtle things about the universe we don't already know. There's a lot of anticipation about James Webb giving us some insights on exactly how stars form when they start off being composed of only hydrogen and helium. It's the only telescope with the power to give us some insight on that. So that will be some new astrophysics. But in terms of, hey, are we going to wind up with an alternate to the Big Bang creation model? In fact, Eric Lerner published an article online saying that the James Webb is overthrowing the Big Bang. Well, it was quite the opposite. It was giving us a stronger case for the Big Bang creation model. We're basically able to narrow down onto what kind of Big Bang creation model explains the history of the universe.
Okay, Craig McMahon online asked, what are the axioms on which the space-time theorems are based?
Okay, what are the assumptions of the space-time theorems? And yes, these theorems, whether they be Greek mathematics theorems that you all learned in your trigonometry class, all theorems are based on fundamental axioms or assumptions. And when you read those space-time theorems, they basically make the point, these theorems prove their point only if certain conditions, assumptions are met. Well, the two most significant of those assumptions is that the universe must contain mass. So if there's no mass in the universe, then the conclusion of the space-time theorems doesn't necessarily follow. It doesn't mean it's wrong, but that you can't prove it. But every one of you here is living proof that the universe does contain mass. No one disputes the conclusion that the universe contains mass. The second one is that the equations of general relativity reliably describe the movements of massive bodies in the universe. So the question is, does general relativity give us an accurate picture of how stars move within our galaxy, or how galaxies move relative to one another? Does it give us an accurate picture of how the universe expands from the cosmic creation event? And we have abundant measurements that tell us general relativity indeed reliably describes the movements of bodies in the universe. The other crucial assumption regards the space-time features of the universe, but that again is something that's not disputed. So yes, there are assumptions behind these space-time theorems, but these assumptions have been rigorously tested by measurement, and therefore they're not disputed.
This question is out of Revelation chapter 19 and 20. In chapter 19, you have this thing called the Marriage Supper of the Lamb.
Yes.
And you have a lot of people that are involved there. And then in chapter 20, you have this scene where books are opened up and people are being judged. Are those that are in the wedding supper of the Lamb involved in that?
Okay. Revelation 19 and 20, as you mentioned, 19 is the wedding feast, and this is where Jesus, the creator of the universe, has a feast with the righteous angels and all the human beings who've decided that they want to spend eternity with him. I mean, God basically says to every human being, where do you want to spend eternity? Do you want to spend eternity with me, or do you want nothing to do with me? If you want nothing to do with God, he's got a place for you. If you want to spend eternity with him, he's got a place for you. You get to choose. And so Revelation 19 is talking about those who have chosen, hey, I want to spend eternity in a loving relationship with the Creator, and everybody else has made that same decision. That's the marriage feast of the Lamb. We celebrate that the work of Christ is done for us on the cross, and our excitement about entering into the new creation, into eternal relationship with him. The judgment for believers is described in 1 Corinthians 3, 12 to 15. And it basically makes the point that those of us who are followers of Jesus Christ still have a lot of baggage. I mean, I can interview each one of you here and basically uncover something about you that people find unpleasant or obnoxious. I mean, we're all still sinners, right? And so there's stuff that is in our life that will be a problem in making it possible to have fully loving, intimate relationships with everybody else in the new creation. And so the promise in 1 Corinthians 3 is before God takes us into that new realm, he's going to take us through what's called a refining fire. And basically, he's going to remove from us everything that people find unpleasant about us or obnoxious about us. And what it says in 1 Corinthians 3, some of them won't have to experience much because they've lived their life for Christ in such a consistent way during their life here on earth, they don't have a lot of dross. And, you know, people tend to like them. They like to be around them. So there's not a lot of obnoxiousness that needs to be erased. But he does make the point, no matter how righteous you are as a believer, you will need to be refined. But some will need to be refined more than others. So, but the promise is, if you go through that refining fire, you're headed for an eternal relationship with the Creator, and you're going to enter that new creation where everybody thinks that you're really fascinating, a loving, righteous person. Everybody's going to want to hang around you and get to know you. So in that sense, going through the refining fire is a gift that God gives us. I don't want to enter into the new creation where people find me obnoxious. So I'm definitely looking forward to going through that refining fire. Revelation 20 is referring to those who said, I want nothing to do with God. And God basically says, well, you're going to be judged. The books will be opened up. And those who want nothing to do with God, their name gets erased. What I find interesting, what I see in the book of Revelation, we all begin with our name in the book of life. But at the end of our life, God says, okay, what decision did they make about a relationship with me? They want nothing to do with me. He erases their name from the book of life. I find that interesting theologically. We all start off in the book of life. But if we choose not to spend eternity with him, he erases our name from the book of life. And instead of that happens to you, then you'll be judged. And you'll be judged according to the evil that you've committed in this life. If you've committed more evil, then you'll experience greater torment in the lake of fire. As I mentioned in my previous response, that Greek word for torment has a connotation of restraint. And it's similar to what we see in our prison system. People who have committed great crimes, they go to a high security prison where there's a lot more restraint upon the prisoners. But for those that have committed minor crimes, they go to a low security prison where there's not that much restraint. Same principle applies in hell. Some will be restrained more, some will be restrained less. Based on the principle, those who have committed much evil are capable of doing much more harm to others in the lake of fire. So God says they'll be given more restraint, because God's goal is, let's not make hell any worse than it is. And my argument is, the worst thing about hell is who else is there. That's what makes hell such a horrible place. It's filled with people who want nothing to do with God. And for some of them, you really don't want to be around them. Fortunately, God imposes restraint on each one of them that's optimized. So that's Revelation chapter 20.
I think we got time for one more question here.
Okay. We'll take one and we'll get you
okay,
out.
Okay, then we'll get out. Okay. Kenny W. has an interesting one. is Lucy a legitimate hominid or a hoax?
Is Lucy a legitimate hominid or a hoax? It's a legitimate skeletal find. It's not a complete skeleton. It's a partial skeleton. So we don't know as much about Lucy as we'd like to know. But Lucy is an Australopithecine dating back, I think, about 2.5 to 3 million years ago. And, you know, shows some limited bipedal capability, but nothing like what you see in Homo erectus Neanderthals, and particularly us human beings. Also, the brain size was a lot smaller than it is for us humans. But it's part of a progression of about 12 bipedal primates that precede humans. I've just written a long chapter for a book that's going to be coming out in a few months, basically making the point that when we look at these bipedal primates, the Neanderthals, the Denisovans, Homo erectus, the Australopithecines, we see that their character attributes and their technological capability is far more akin to what we see with chimpanzees and orangutans than us human beings. There is a huge gulf between the most advanced non-human bipedal primate and us human beings. Okay, you'll now, be last out.
Do you have a question now?
Yeah, last thing that you said before that question was the, it sounds like you were making a case for purgatory.
No, I'm not making a case for purgatory, Al. I'm basically saying.
It's either hell or heaven, is that
it? It's hell or heaven, there is no purgatory.
Okay. That's the stuff the church, the Catholic Church teaches.
Well, the Catholic Church teaches, maybe you got to spend some time paying off the offenses that you committed in your life. What you see in the Protestant faith is that Jesus paid the offense for all of our sins, past, present, and future. There is no need for purgatory because Jesus paid it all.
Paid in full.
Paid in full, exactly. However, becoming a Christian is accepting that payment in full. I've run into people who say, you know what? I'm okay with him forgiving me of some of my sins, but I want to take care of the others. And God is basically saying, you can't take care of any of it. If I don't take care of it, you're in deep trouble. So he's basically saying, trust me, I can take care of it. Nobody else can.
Okay. Thank you, Dr. Ross. And I think Dan had a question, but we're getting a little late.
Okay, right, really Dan, quick, and then we got to close.
Got to be a short one, Dan.
Sir, my boss is an atheist. I never heard him. Have you heard how the atheist explained the universe?
Yes, I've debated several atheist scientists about the universe. And basically, they punt to what's called the multiverse. They say God didn't create the universe. They do admit there's all these design features in the universe, but they hypothesize that the universe is an infinite number of universes where they're all different from one another. And if you got a true infinite number of universes, then by pure chance you get all these amazing design features we see in the universe that make our existence possible. And what I've done in those debates is basically say, well, one of your fellow atheists, Leonard Susskind, years ago, spoke at a conference and wound up writing an article basically saying, we who are atheists and agnostic scientists need to stop using the multiverse. It's a bad argument because it explains everything. And an argument that explains everything explains nothing. You know, I've been speaking on the fine-tuned designs of the universe since the 1970s. And I remember in the 1980s telling audiences, the evidence is becoming overwhelming. It won't be long before the evidence for the fine-tuned designs in the universe to make the existence of us human beings possible, it'll be so pervasive and so overwhelming, atheists will have nowhere else to go but to hypothesize an infinite number of universes where they're all different from one another. Well, 20 years later, that's exactly what happened. They said the multiverse had did it all. Now, Leonard Susskind didn't really give us any analogy for the point he was making, but I'll give you one. You know, infinity plus infinity is infinity. Infinity times infinity is infinity. Infinity to the infinity power is infinity. So it's not just one infinity we're talking about, multiple infinities. So if you have an infinite number of universes all are different from one another, you'll get an infinite number of planets just like planet Earth. And those infinite number of planets, you're going to have an infinite variety of species of life. In particular, you have an infinite variety of species of birch trees. And birch trees have the property they peel thin white pieces of bark. And if you've got an infinite variety of birch tree species, one of those species will peel thin white pieces of bark that are perfectly rectangular and measure 8.5 by 11 inches. And these pieces of bark will fall on soil that'll make random markings on those pieces of birch. And if you look at all those pieces of birch bark, you'll see in them every photograph, every equation, every table, every diagram, and every paragraph that appears in every scientific paper that's ever been written. Which means you can conclude those millions of scientific research papers we see didn't come from the minds of scientists. The multiverse did it. So you're basically making the point, if you're going to appeal to the multiverse to get rid of God's design, you simultaneously get rid of all human designs. And so the multiverse is basically self-refuting.
Okay.
Okay.
Can you pray us out, Doctor?
I'll pray us out. Yeah. Father in heaven, we thank you for this day that you've given us here in October. And we thank you, Lord, that you give us many days in which we can see what you've revealed to us in the record of nature and in the pages of the Bible. And Father, I pray you would give us the wisdom, the grace and the humility to study these books and learn from you what you want us to discover about you, about your creation, and how you want us to live our lives here on earth and to prepare for life in the new creation. In Jesus' name, amen.